case of the day, the United States versus Hallahan. Mr. Hansmeier.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Dan Hansmeier. I'm an attorney with the Federal Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois. Represent the appellant, Janet Hallahan. I'll also be presenting oral argument for Nelson Hallahan as well. These appeals involve fraud-related convictions and convictions for failure to appear for sentencing. There are quite a number of issues. What I want to focus on, obviously, is the enforceability of the appeal waivers. That issue is dispositive, I think, with respect to the fraud-related convictions because, obviously, if this court enforces the appeal waivers, the government will prevail. If this court does not enforce the appeal waiver, there is a conceded guidelines miscalculation, which would be plain reversible error. So in that respect, that issue is somewhat simple. Beyond that, I do want to also discuss the five-year consecutive sentences in the failure to appear sentences because those are not controlled by an appeal waiver. So regardless of what happens in the appeal waiver context, there's still an argument to be made that those five-year sentences should go back for resentencing. Now, on the enforceability of the appeal waivers, I think what we have is arguably an issue of first impression in this court, and that is essentially whether the government can seek specific performance of an appeal waiver when it does not honor its obligations under the plea agreement below. Now, essentially what happens in this case, obviously they don't show for sentencing. Later they do when they're caught. The government...
Could you raise your voice, sir?
Yes, this is
a big room.
Right. I'm sorry.
The microphone is for recording rather than magnifying.
I'm sorry. So what we have here is a plea agreement that requires the government to do things. Five things in particular. Now, with respect to those five obligations, there's one obligation that has conditions, and that is the recommendation of the three-level reductions for acceptance responsibility. And that, the express conditions involved in that include pre-sentencing conduct. And so, when the defendants don't show for sentencing, based on the plain language of the plea agreement, the government is no longer bound to recommend those three levels. We agree with that. But nothing in the plea agreement releases the government from any of its other obligations. And so in this case, and one particular obligation that we've alleged, we think there are three breaches. But one in particular is the agreement to recommend a sentence at the low end of the guidelines range. That clearly did not happen in this case. The government's recommendation was, in quote, the longest of sentences. And that would be considered a serious breach of the plea agreement under this court's precedent. And so we do have a breach. And so our position is simple. And it is, if the government wants to enforce an appeal waiver, it has to...
I think you're going to need to expand on that because okay. I, at least, don't see any breach. What the prosecutor agreed to do was recommend a sentence at the low end of the guidelines to begin in the year 2000.
Okay.
As a result of your client's flight, any recommendation would be for a sentence to begin in the year 2013.
Okay.
And in order to have the same deterrent force for a sentence beginning in the year 2013, it has to be much longer. Future is discounted back to present value. And if we discount to present value at a normal rate, say 5% a year, a sentence beginning in 2013 needs to be at least twice as long to be as defective as a deterrent as a sentence beginning in the year 2000. Now, why can't the prosecutor consider that?
Well, I think my response to that is, in this context, the government indicted these people for failure to appear. So that can be done.
That's a second crime.
Correct.
We're talking about what the sentence has to be for the underlying crime, the fraud.
Correct. Well, the plea agreement is clear that the government will recommend a sentence at the low end of the guidelines range. Now, to the extent that they are sentenced in 1 year and not the next, that's not something contemplated by the agreement.
No, it's not contemplated by the agreement because the agreement doesn't have an escape clause. But if one understands an agreement like this as a recommendation that the government thinks that a sentence at the bottom of the guidelines will be adequate for punishment and deterrence, when the sentence is actually imposed 13 years later, it has to be higher because otherwise the defendants are helping themselves by their escape. And I don't think one can maintain with a straight face that this agreement should be read to allow the defendants to better their own position by violating other laws.
I don't follow the better their positions.
It comes from the concept of discounting things to present value.
Okay. But that's not contemplated by the agreement.
Exactly. The agreement doesn't say, and I trust you're not asking us to read it as saying, the defendants retain the right to better their own position, that is, to put off and therefore diminish the force of punishment by violating some other law. And the prosecutor is stuck. The prosecutor has to give the defendant that benefit, any self-help benefit they can get by escaping. Reading the plea agreement that way would commit the prosecutor to an insane position.
I disagree, especially in this case where the additional conduct is a specific offense characteristic within the new range. The guidelines range goes up two levels based on this conduct, and on top of that, there's a new
The guidelines
new
range
conviction.
Goes up two levels if they escape for a day or if they escape for 13 years.
Correct.
But there's a big difference in the deterrent force whether they fail to appear for one day or whether they fail to appear for one decade.
I agree, and I think that's something the district court can consider, but I don't understand how that alters the terms of the plea agreement.
Aren't there cases, though, that say that even if it's not made explicit in the agreement, it's implied that they'll comply with the law?
Well, and that's Munoz.
Yeah,
correct.
And a failure to comply results in the government being it excuses the government's obligation to make the same recommendation.
Well, that's fine, and we're not. My position is not that the breach is itself a reason for this court to remand for resentencing. That's not our. We haven't raised a breach argument. Our argument is that yes, the government is free to do that, but once they do that, once the government fails to honor its obligations, they cannot then seek specific performance of the plea agreement.
Well, the whole you haven't sought. No one's claiming that the entire agreement is void or should be rescinded. You're not seeking to withdraw pleas, or are you?
No.
Okay. So, certain provisions of the agreement, certain obligations the government had, would then be forgiven by virtue of the breach that you have. They don't have the obligation to maintain the same recommendation. But that doesn't mean that all of the agreement, including the appeal waiver, is gone, does it?
But it does. It means under
If that's true, then isn't the entire plea agreement gone and even the guilty pleas are removed or are taken away?
No, I don't think that's true. I mean, the bottom line is that in at least six circuits, the rule of law is that if the government breaches a plea agreement, an appeal waiver is unenforceable.
Yep. But look, counsel, the questions you're receiving from both Judge Griesbach and me have to do with whether there is a breach.
Is that you don't think there was a breach either?
When the defendant violates his own obligations in such a way that it makes the performance of the prosecutor's obligations inappropriate, the prosecutor doesn't perform those obligations.
And
that's
fine.
The problem you're facing.
Performance is forgiven, in other words. The obligation to make a particular recommendation, just like the obligation to make to recommend reduction for acceptance of responsibility, is forgiven by virtue of your own client's breach of the plea agreement. But the rest of the agreement remains in effect.
Well, but that's, I guess I disagree with that. That is not what other courts have held. And I think in United States v. Mason, this court, you know, this is a quote, if the plea agreement turns out to be unenforceable, maybe because the government committed a material breach, the waiver falls with the agreement and the appellant can appeal. I mean, that's our argument.
If the plea agreement is unenforceable.
Correct.
But I assume you are not arguing that your own client's escape made the plea agreement unenforceable. And that would go nowhere. But your client's escape may relieve the government from particular obligations that make no sense or are inappropriate after your clients flee to avoid serving their sentence. That's the question that's being asked of you in multiple ways.
My argument
Your argument seems to be that your clients get all the benefits and they receive the right to escape without relieving the prosecutor of obligations that, in light of an escape, don't make any sense.
Well, that can't be true because they didn't receive the benefits. I'm not arguing that my clients have received a benefit and now want more benefits. My
Your
argument is that
they have received a benefit. All the dismissed charges have stayed dismissed, for example.
But we conceded below the government could reinstate those charges. I mean, that was and this is a case where they're sentenced based on everything anyway. Whether they plead to 2 counts or 30, it's the same thing. So this is a case where our clients didn't get the benefit they bargained for, and so they should be allowed to appeal.
And that got the benefit they bargained for, but then they gave up some of those benefits by committing additional crimes. That's a perfectly straightforward proposition.
Of which I disagree, and I think this court has disagreed. I think Munoz is an example of where this court, in that case, it is an analogous factual situation. The government came to this court after breaching the agreement and did not enforce the appeal waiver. This court writes an opinion saying, implying that that was the proper thing to do. That there are situations, essentially the government has a choice. You have a choice. Do you want to honor your obligations or not? If you don't honor your obligations, do not come to this court and expect the defendants not to appeal. The government had a decision to make. It made it. It should be stuck with it, and this appeal should go forward, as it would be allowed to go forward in the other circuits, and as implied in Munoz and Mason and contract law in general. And that's our
thing. All right. Thank you, Mr. Hansmeier. Mr. Golden?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Ross Goldman for the United States. I'll begin by addressing the appeal waiver. The appeal waiver here is enforceable. The defendants never contest that they entered into the waiver knowingly, willfully, or voluntarily, and they do not contest that the waiver is unambiguous as to its meaning and scope. The appeal waiver, therefore, is enforceable, and it's enforceable for multiple reasons, one of which is that the plea agreement itself makes all of the government's obligations conditional on the defendant's performance. The defendants ascribe no meaning to the prefatory language that introduces all of the government's obligations in the plea agreement. And that prefatory language, this is found at the government supplemental appendix, page 31, says, if the defendant completely fulfills all of his or her obligations under this plea agreement, the government will. And then it enumerates those responsibilities and those obligations. When the defendants fail to appear, they fail to perform and what this court in Munoz called an implied but obvious term of every plea agreement that the defendants show up for sentencing. That failure to appear relieved the government's obligation to perform. That has no effect on the appeal waiver. It doesn't vitiate that waiver. It doesn't render that waiver unenforceable. That's consistent with the line of cases cited in our brief, in particular the Quintero decision, among others, holding that a defendant's non-performance can excuse a government's obligation and yet still have a valid and enforceable waiver of appellate rights. And so for that reason, and there are other reasons as well that are set forth in our brief as to why it was that in this particular case there was no breach of the plea agreement on the part of the government. If there was no breach, there's no reason, certainly, for allowing the defendants out of their waiver of appellate rights. On the issue of, so that's the appeal waiver. The appeal waiver, we think, covers most, though we concede not all of the claims raised by the defendants in this appeal. I want to turn now to the ex post facto clause issue. We explain in our brief that the combination of the one book rule plus the grouping rules provides all the notice that the ex post facto clause requires. That's this court's decision in Vivit. It's the First Circuit's decision in Pagan Ferrer, which was a post Supreme Court Pew decision agreeing with Vivit.
Have any courts other than the First considered this question after Pew?
Not that we're aware of, Your Honor. And the defendants don't dispute any of this. They don't address it in their opening brief. They don't dispute it in their reply. They make two different arguments. They say, one, the government waived this Vivit argument by not making it in the district court. But, of course, at the time of sentencing in the district court, this court's then-governing precedent was crystal clear that the ex post facto clause did not apply to the application of the sentencing guidelines. So there would be no reason for the government to say that the clause is satisfied when it was so clear that the clause did not apply. The second point that the defendants make is the government never established that the 2012 guidelines are the appropriate guidelines in this case. And for that, and this is made for the first time in their reply brief, it's subject to review for plain error. It was not raised, this particular issue wasn't raised below, but under any standard, the 2012 guidelines were the correct guidelines because the failure to appear offense is a continuing offense. That's this court's holding in the McIntosh decision, which we provided to the court in the 28J letter earlier this week. Because it's a continuing offense, it means that the defendants committed that crime every day from May 4th of 2000 when they failed to appear at the sentencing hearing through May of 2012 when they were arrested. And the guidelines say to apply the version in effect at the time of sentencing unless doing so would cause an ex post facto violation, in which case you use the book in effect at the time the offense was committed. Here, the sentencing took place in late November of 2012. That would implicate the 2012 guidelines. The crime, the failure to appear crime, was committed.
That loses me. It would be the November 2011 book, would it not?
I believe it's the 2012 guidelines went into effect November 1st of 2011.
Well, it's odd to call them 2012 since they cover 2 months of 2011, but it's the November 2011 book.
Yes, Your Honor, that's right. Now, there's no difference between in the guidelines calculations between that book, the book in effect at the time of sentencing, and the book in effect in May of 2012 when they committed the failure to appear offense. And if there's no difference, there's no ex post facto problem with applying the 2012 guidelines. That's why the 2012 guidelines are the appropriate guidelines to apply in this case. On the issue of the conceded guidelines error here, we assert in our answering brief that that falls squarely within the scope of the enforceable waiver of appellate rights. In the defendant's reply brief, they take the position that because there was no waiver of appellate rights with respect to the failure to appear and because everything was grouped together, that there's some derivative effect on the failure to appear from this error, and so for that reason the court needs to undo either just the failure to appear or all of the sentences. I think the better way to look at it, though, is the nature of the particular error here was one that related solely to the calculation of the offense level on count 18. It had to do with the base. Everyone agrees that count 18, this is the money laundering conspiracy count. This was the count that was going to drive the range for the group. And the relevant guideline here is 2S1.1. And that subsection A provides that the base offense level is the offense level for the underlying offense from which the funds were laundered. That would be the fraud guideline 2B1.1. 2B1.1A sets a base offense level of 7 if two criteria are satisfied, and if not, 6. That's the error that we concede right there, the 2B1.1A error. That relates solely to count 18, and to see that, consider that if the defendants had showed up for sentencing on May 4th and had never failed to appear, if nothing else changed about this guidelines calculation, there would still be the error. But there'd be no question that would fall within the scope of the waiver of appellate rights. And so for that reason, it would be, as Judge Easterbrook noted in opposing counsel's presentation, it can't be the case that the defendants get some kind of benefit for having committed the future crime of failure to appear. And because this error would have been within the scope of the waiver without anything to do with the failure to appear, it remains covered by the waiver of appellate rights. I think the last point I'd like to make, unless there are further questions from the court, is with respect to the argument about Janet's alternative motion to withdraw from the plea agreement. In the defendant's reply brief, they take the position that the government has misunderstood the burden on harmless error and that we have placed the burden on her to show harmless error. That's simply not true. The reason that the error is harmless is because there's only one plausible outcome to her motion, and that's that the motion should be denied because Janet, for the reasons advanced in our brief, cannot come forward with the requisite fair and just reason for withdrawing from the plea agreement. And this court has held in criminal cases and civil cases that if there's an abuse of discretion by the district court, if the outcome can only be one way, this court can just resolve it without sending it back to the district court. And we submit that that is the appropriate path to take in this case. I suppose I'll make one final point, and I will be brief, because it's something that comes up again for the first time in reply, the notion that the government breached its obligations by failing to present mitigating evidence to the district court. I just want to point out that that's belied by the record in substantial part and is otherwise just unavailing. So the issue with Nelson's health concerns and the lack of prior convictions, the prosecutor brought both of those points to the district court's attention at the sentencing hearing. Janet's role in the offense was not a mitigating factor for all of the reasons that her sentence was substantively reasonable. And the fact that the defendants assert that they committed no additional crimes during the 12 years approximately that they were on the run isn't a mitigating factor because, again, it's a continuing offense. They committed that crime every single day during their period on the run. If there are no further, I'm happy to entertain further questions. If there are no further, the government will rest on its briefs.
Do you want to address the argument that the district court's sentencing on the failure to appear was improper because the manner in which he structured it was contrary to the the guideline provisions governing that aspect of it?
I think it was actually consistent with the guidelines. The relevant guideline here is the 2J1.6, and that says it says a couple of things. It says the failure to appear is to be grouped with the underlying offense and treated as a specific offense characteristic and obstruction. And that, and this is, you know, it points to the statute, that any sentence imposed on the failure to appear, if one is imposed at all, must run consecutively to the term imposed on the underlying offense. And that what the court is supposed to do in this situation is determine a total punishment and then apportion that punishment between the underlying offenses and the failure to appear such that when the totals are added together, again, because they must run consecutively, they equal the court's chosen total punishment. The district court not only explained the guideline, but explained it correctly, understood that they were grouped, understood the specific enhanced characteristic, understood that the sentences need to be apportioned, and followed through on that. The fact that there was an upward variance here, there's certainly no legal error with the court deciding that an upward variance was appropriate, especially whereas in this case, the court put all of those reasons on the record. There were substantial reasons, and the court connected up all those reasons to the factors set forth in 3553A.
Thank you, Mr. Goldman. Mr. Hansmeier?
Not much time. On the 5-year sentence, which I didn't get to, if what the government just said is true, then you do have a guidelines miscalculation with respect to the failure to appear sentences. Because if it was correctly calculated, that aspect, there was only one guideline range for all counts. So if that's the one guidelines range, it was miscalculated. The government concedes that. So essentially the government is asking you to affirm a sentence that is based on an incorrect guidelines range. Now, the other way of looking at that is our argument in our brief that the district court actually got the 2J1.6 argument wrong. And if that's true, then the 5-year consecutive sentences should be vacated as well. So I think it's an alternative that the government can't get out of. Either there was an error with respect to Judge Griesbach's question, or at the end of the day, it's one range, the range is miscalculated, and it has to go back. So that's simple. Now, on Janet's motion to withdraw from the plea agreement, The argument is simple. The district court never addressed it. The district court never denied it, never ruled on it. And so that is an abuse of discretion. It is an abuse of discretion to failure to exercise your discretion.
I don't even understand the concept. You can either withdraw the plea or not. I don't understand the concept of withdrawing from the plea agreement. It's not a request to withdraw from the agreement. It's a request, please liberate us from our own promises. And I think that's the null set. Why would the district court have to address that?
Well, because there's a case from this court that says it's okay. The United States v. Standiford says that if a defendant can show a fair and just reason to withdraw from a plea agreement, he can do so.
That just sounds like some mistaken language. So fair and just, the rule says if you show a fair and just reason, you can withdraw the plea.
Correct.
But there's no rule of criminal procedure that says you can keep the plea but withdraw from the agreement.
That may be true, but at the end of the day, this court and other circuits, other courts of appeals, have extended the fair and just reason to this situation. So unless this court wants to abandon Standiford, that's the law.
Unless this court wishes to enforce the rules of criminal procedure as they're written.
Well, I mean, that may be true, Judge.
The Supreme Court keeps telling us that that's what we should be doing rather than inventing different rules of criminal procedure.
Right. I mean, my point is that there is a case that says the district court has the discretion to do that, and it should have done it. And thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hansmeier. Mr. Golden, thank you. Case is taken under advisement.